Welcome to the A-Team Group podcast on navigating the emerging SI landscape, recorded at the recent MiFID II briefing entitled Interacting with the New Market Structure, held on the 18th of September in the City of London. Moderated by Jeremy Bruce, Managing Director of Prime Services Platform Sales EMEA at Société Générale, the podcast includes a discussion on the different types of SI liquidity and devaluation, how to manage the complexity around near real-time trade reporting to APAs, the state of play on ISINs for OTC derivatives, the global issue of LEIs, and what the future could hold for the SI regime. Panelists include Simon Dove, Head of Liquidity Management at Tower Research Capital Europe, Jonathan Finney, Director of European Business Development at Citadel Securities, Peter Moss, CEO of SmartStream RDU, John Mason, Global Head of Regulatory and Market Structure Propositions for the Financial and Risk Division of Thomson Reuters, now known as Refinitiv, and Malavika Solanki, a member of the management team for the Derivatives Service Bureau.
I'm Jeremy Bruce from SocGen. We're obviously in the bank SI camp. And sure enough, we're SI in OTC, and listed in equities, fixed income, commodities, and all that stuff. So maybe if we just run along the panel, just a quick introduction of yourself and maybe the one-liner on the organisation you work for.
John Mason from Thomson Reuters. I'm our head of market structure and regulatory propositions. So basically, we look at all of the changes in the market and determine how we need to respond to those on behalf of our clients.
Hi, Jonathan Finney, Director of European Business Development, joined Citadel Securities 7 months ago, and prior to that I spent 12 years at Fidelity running their electronic trading desk. I've been helping Citadel Securities basically build out their SI for equities and ETF instruments.
Peter Moss, I'm the CEO of the Reference Data Utility. We provide data for MiFID, but we also have a relationship with the APA community, where we actually provide a register of systematic internalizer services, who's providing SI services in what instruments, which is actually starting to become a little bit more interesting as we get more targeted SIs coming into the market with fixed income and OTC derivatives in March.
Hi, Simon Dove, Tower Research Capital. I'm Head of Liquidity Management and Business Development for Europe. Credit Suisse kindly called me the Head Smoozer earlier, so I need to get some new business cards printed. But broadly, we're a quant-driven market-making firm. We've deployed and have the largest ELP SI in Europe currently by volume, and obviously keen to break down some of these myths and address and hopefully have quite an interactive discussion around why the SI regime is good. And some of the regulatory changes and some of the things we've heard about this morning aren't necessarily ideal for the end user.
I'm Malavika Solanki. I'm part of the management team of the Derivative Service Bureau. In essence, and Jeremy mentioned this actually when we were talking earlier, most of today's discussion has been focused on cash equities and some of the more, and again, the physical fixed side. Our focus in terms of the DSB was set up more or less a year ago as a result of MiFID II, and specifically what the firm does is provide ISINs for OTC derivatives so that people can pick up that data and then do their reference data reporting onwards.
Great. Okay, so to start off then, so different types of SI, different types of liquidity, different qualities of liquidity. Maybe just to kick off, if I can ask John and Simon.
Arm wrestle?
Yeah. No, you're not sitting next to each other. So, you know, the ELP space, just to start off with, a bit of mystique around it, but at times maybe some suspicion, whether that's justified or not. Maybe you can just give us a bit of a sort of a sense of the ELP space, what kind of liquidity is available, what kind of players are in there, and maybe just even a bit of a profile around what it is that you look to do within the ELP space.
Why don't you?
Simon, do you want to go first?
Yeah, of course. Cool. So from my side, I think, just to give you a bit of background, kind of broadly 6 or 7 years post the LSE working around market making and liquidity provision, predominantly around sort of MTS exchanges and BCNs, joined Tower 2 years ago to drive our SI initiative and a few other things. Broadly, we were already providing and were one of the biggest participants in terms of BCNs and liquidity provision. There is a skill around kind of liquidity and providing liquidity into BCNs and other venues, which are much more kind of bilateral collateral by nature, and that is around providing liquidity that is conducive with consumption, and that is, you know, the trade sizes, price improvement, and actually having the ability to take on material risk and offsetting that in a very efficient way. So we are a market maker. We have hold periods in the minutes, hours, and days. We carry overnight risk. You know, these are the things that have kind of historically are regularly thrown at us as something we don't do. So I think the SI regime in Europe, for me, has kind of defined the landscape in a much more materially relevant way. There's more information out there about firms like us and Citadel and others that have launched SIs. The information that's being shared from our partners on the sell side to the buy side, I think, is much more evidently providing a landscape for understanding kind of why we're additive to what we're looking at. And let's be very clear, the SI regime is additive to the ecosystem we all operate in. To Kay's comment and some of the panelists earlier, we talk about innovation and the evolution of the landscape. SI is just kind of additive to where people need to trade. It's not the only place you should trade, and it's not right for every order. But actually, the metrics that are currently coming out of the relevant SIs in the space are actually indicating that we're doing quite a good job. The landscape, I guess, and particularly as we now, this is, as a proprietary trading firm, we've never really had counterparties or relationships before in this way. So actually it's essential that we resource and we recalibrate our focus to provide what is an exceptional experience, because this is a very one-dimensional relationship. If you don't like what you see when you trade against us, you don't come back. And actually, the reality of the landscape, which we heard earlier today, is with dark volume caps, the potential for non-mid crossing, which I think is ludicrous, it within the current landscape, is just bizarre. I mean, we are, as a market maker, happy to give price improvement to the end investor, who ultimately is who we should all be looking after. But actually, the regulator is going to say to me, driven by some of the continental exchanges who choose not to compete, actually, mid should not be permitted. And that's troublesome in a lot of ways. So I think the landscape is clearly becoming much more transparent. Firms like ourselves and Citadel and others are becoming much more relevant to the discussion. And the volumes for us, I mean, I mentioned numbers, you know, Citadel, ourselves and Jane Street now publish our numbers via Rosenblatt and TAP. The transparency around our ADVs are now there. And actually, that creates an awareness of actually what's achievable. And actually, if you want to interact with us below SMS, the liquidity is there and it's of good quality and it's in line with the tick size. And if you want to interact with us above SMS, by the way, there's 10 times SMS available there with some level of price improvement. And actually, the tick size debate around SIs is somewhat of a damp squid in my mind. If we're forced to align ourselves with tick sizes, we don't have a problem with that. I'm a market maker. You're going to force me to widen my spreads. What we shouldn't do is remove the ability to have mid-price improvement available to the end participant, which ultimately is a benefactor of all of this regulation. I ranted a bit. Finney, feel free to jump in. Apologies or questions, whatever is.
I actually agree with a lot of what Simon says, and I'm going to let him kind of single out the opportunities and the greatest value of individual SIs. I think to re-emphasize the point I was making earlier is that I've spent 12 years at Fidelity kind of building out their electronic trading analysis and their platform, the Wheel, for example. And so I spent a lot of my time at Citadel Securities kind of like still thinking about what I would have wanted if I was still on the buy side. So I echo a lot of what Simon is saying. I think there is this new breed of risk warehousing market maker that I think a lot of people are now starting to really learn and get a bit more education around. But ultimately, from what Simon has said and what John has said, I would very much ask the buy side to be speaking to the brokers as to how do you evaluate what we've just said? How do you verify that? So like three metrics which I think are crucial, and Simon did allude to this in the fact that a lot of brokers are actually doing this analysis already, is around unique liquidity. Is there an actual reason to have SIs? Like, obviously we think so, but you shouldn't always take our word for it. Go have a look, ask your brokers. Quality of liquidity, like is the sizes that are on offer, is the impact that you're seeing from trading relevant or not, and quantity of liquidity. The beauty of the SI regime is that these are quotes to you first. You do not give away information. You get this information first, right, and then you can do with it in terms of analysis as you will. So you can actually take these quotes, have a look at them, and then assess whether you want to trade against them or not. So the beauty of the SI regime is that you actually don't have any opportunity cost. You can actually take these in. There is no fragmentation from that aspect. So to bring this back to why I think Citadel Securities is kind of like as additive in the same way that Tower is that we are actually quite transparent in terms of like how we're trying to approach this. We are reporting in Rosenblatt, to echo your points, but also the brokers have this information and they can tell you this in terms of these metrics which really matter to evaluating SIs.
just one point on landscape as well, which is another criticism for firms that run SIs. We haven't changed our behaviour on public venues. We still represent 8 to 12% of the European market from an equity perspective. So we're relevant and sizable. This is not a shift into an SI. It's complementary to what we're doing. It's committing additional capital. It's the appetite to provide better price improvement and put it in a way that actually, to be transparent with you, and I hear this a lot from some of the regulators, we fixed the lit venue so everyone trade there. Well, actually, not every trade is appropriate for the lit venue. The reality is, excluding market data fees, which are monopolistic and wrong, I have to say that one because everyone expects me to pick that one up at some point. Also, it's potentially one of the more predatory places to trade. So it's just not appropriate. But actually, it's still, as mentioned, there was a poll this morning about where is the most liquidity. It still remains on the primaries. And so we're additive to that. So there isn't any reason to be scared. I still say to this day, and what frustrates me is a lot of the things that have come out today and the discussions previously is, some continental exchanges choosing not to compete. They want the regulator to defend their market model, and that's wrong. I want to cite, you know, Cboe, LSE, innovation, choice, adding new platforms, and actually Euronext on their block stuff. Veronica's here, she'd tell me off, didn't mention her. They are innovating, so they're offering choice. And actually that choice is, do you know what? If you've got an order and your intention and your output is measurable and your what you'd like to achieve, a certain venue is right for that, conditional, periodics, then that's where you should be trading. Or an SI if you want that on a bilateral basis.
Great. Perhaps just opening it out a bit more widely then. John started to talk about evaluation there. Just in general, if you're at the buy side or even an intermediary, you're just thinking, right, what is the population of SIs? What data do I need to start even beginning evaluating them? I don't know, maybe John, if you had any thoughts, Peter and Malavika as well, just the kinds of data that are out there that you can pull to look at to start to get a sense of the SI landscape and even just the first steps of what you might be looking at to try and evaluate or discern between them.
Okay, I mean, I think from our side, we, as I think Tom touched on in the previous talk, we tend to consume our SI data through the APAs. So there's the mechanism through which the data is published out to the marketplace. So we receive that data from the APAs, and then certain clients are looking to take that data real time, and others are looking at it on an end of day, sort of the free to air, if I can put it that way, view of the world. So organisations would consume that data from us in one of those two mechanisms, I guess. What we've done, of course, is we've looked to standardise, normalise that data across the various APAs that we consume it. But to Jonathan's point, we're not publishing SI data at that level, i.e. directly from the SIs. We're always going to be taking the data from that intermediary, from the APA, and publishing it. So first step for our clients is to come to us and say we would like to consume this data from the APAs, and then they decide whether that's pre-trade or post-trade.
So we're very much playing in the space where the question is the person I'm trading with an SI. In the equities market, I think actually, which we spent a lot of time talking about today, it's a lot more transparent. There's a lot of liquidity out there, and there are a lot more choices. In the fixed income market, where the mandatory regime literally kicked in 2.5 weeks ago, I think it's a very different story. And I think a lot of the landscape is still actually undecided, and it will evolve, I think, over the next few months. And we've not even really touched on the OTC derivative space, which actually doesn't go into a mandatory regime until the 1st of March. So for us, it's much more around, are the counterparties that I'm trading with actually providing SI services in the space that I actually want to trade? And when you get into more esoteric markets, Aussie dollar swaps and so on for OTC derivatives, then I think it's going to become a little bit more interesting. Equities, I think it's much more about best execution and price.
And Peter, I mean, just to elaborate on that, so we're talking about the SI landscape, and in some of the previous panels we've talked about sort of the fluid nature of the marketplace. As a consequence of that mandatory regime, there's something like 23, 24 new SIs that are now registered, you know, with ESMA, who will be doing pre-trade publishing and who will be effective within that marketplace, whereas prior to the 1st of September, they weren't registered as SIs, but they've been pulled in as a consequence of the mandatory regime and the threshold. The next wave of that will be, as Peter touched on, will be when we publish, or when ESMA publishes the OTC derivative thresholds. But bear in mind, of course, those are quarterly publications of thresholds as well. So there may be some changes, and within that 133 SIs, there may be some SIs who were already as SIs but got caught by the mandatory regime for new instruments, so therefore haven't necessarily registered as a new SI in the same way. For some reason, predominantly the bunch of Austrians and Germans who registered as SIs who got caught. So it is a very, very fluid landscape, and therefore those APAs, for example, now have 23 new organisations that need to get published into the marketplace, which we will then consume and pass on to our clients. So it is, and we've touched on this before, technically a difficult market, because these aren't insignificant changes that take place every 3-6 months or so that the market's doing.
I've just got one point I wanted to make on that, actually, which is that there's obviously a lot of complex natures around SIs, and I think it's at 133, did you say SIs, right? So I'm just trying to think of actual genuine action points we can take away from this. So yes, it's very complicated, but ultimately the buy side should be working as part of their organisation to go, okay, right, of those 133, which ones are actual trading SIs, which ones are reporting SIs, and actually build up a little bit more understanding that actually of the 133, there aren't actually that many that you're going to be genuinely interacting with. So I'm just keen that when we talk about data, 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 we've got to be actually coming up with action points as to how do we take this forward. And the same with the complexity of SIs, we should be thinking, okay, right, 133, what does that actually mean? What can we do? Like, which ones are reporting, which ones are trading, and what kind of information can we get out of it? That's what evaluation is all about.
Yeah,
I think that's where this gets interesting, though, right? Because because of what we do, from where we sit, is actually really interesting. We end up having conversations with firms that thought they were going to be SIs when the OTC derivative regime was supposed to kick in on the 1st of September. The venues obviously joined much earlier. A number of the banks that joined the SI register were there. But the interesting thing, really, for this group's perspective is, alongside that, we get an enormous number of questions coming in from firms that are customers of SIs or think they might be customers of SIs, looking to understand, to Jonathan's point, looking to understand, who do I actually want to execute with? What might that look like? Which of my SIs could offer me assisted reporting? What asset classes might a particular institution be caught up in from an SI perspective? Because there are firms, I think as Peter and John was talking about, there are firms that are on the SI register. That's not enough. It's about what asset class, and also how, from what we can hear, it's about how that institution can then help facilitate what you need. And in some instances, those institutions are able to do so where you're meaningful to them size. In other places, we spend a lot of time with buy side, but also small regional credit institutions, smaller banks, because the scale of people caught up in this is quite significant. And we spend a lot of time to kind of trying to help those institutions navigate what data we make available and when, so that they can then make their own strategic choices about not just price and execution, but from a reporting or a trading perspective, what does that mean for me strategically? Because these are not relationships you're going to change every 3 months. It's expensive.
Yeah, and just to clarify, there are 133 SIs registered with ESMA. We calculate that there are about 85 to 90 that are actually active today. That means there's another 43 that are probably looking at becoming SIs in some specific set of instruments. It could be Spanish bonds, it could be Australian sort of dollar euro swaps, it could be, we were talking to a German Landesbank yesterday who has some very specific sort of niche requirements around particular sort of fixed income instruments. So I mean, the SI landscape is not, we'll be an SI and we'll be an SI for everything. It's we'll be an SI and we'll be an SI for a very specific set of instruments for probably at least 40 or 50% of the firms.
Okay, so just focusing, before we move on equities again, okay, so imagine we're on the buy side, and we say, "Oh, it sounds quite good. I quite like what Simon Jonathan said. It all sounds, you know, it's quite interesting." On the other hand, there's 133 SIs and so on. You know, how should the buy side interact with you? Should they try and is it feasible to send orders directly? Would you recommend they come through some sort of aggregator, speak to their broker about their smart order router? How should they go about accessing your liquidity?
Do you want to go first?
No, I went first last time. I'm on to you.
I 100% think that in this day and age, you really should be partnering up with your brokers to kind of like look at this stuff. I mean, they have the analysis. The one aspect that I found quite quite tricky in my previous role is the fact that it is very hard to get a data set that is statistically significant. And with the amount of venues and SIs and alternative liquidity sources now, it's even more difficult to do so. So I would very much be partnering with Jeremy or with other brokers to basically say, okay, right, so Simon and John have made a good pitch in terms of what they're talking about. They talk about high average quote sizes. They talk about low impact. What are you seeing? Like, what is your data telling you? So this is where it's a three-way feedback mechanism now, where for the first time in equities, you can actually evaluate a market maker. So let's say that and the regulators get their way and the SI regime does go, you'll at least know what the market makers are relevant or not, and therefore if it moves to an RFQ environment, you will know which ones are the right ones to interact with. So this is why it's so important to take the opportunities we have to really evaluate market makers when we have the opportunity.
Yeah, and I mean, just to echo some of the discussion that happened earlier today around BCNs, you know, the SI regime is pre and post trade transparent. I have quotes up and above SMS available via APA. You know, not everyone has. I would encourage all of the SIs to increase their size away from just the material 10%, because I think it shows and demonstrates to the regulator this is not just a reiteration of the BCN landscape. And I think to Finney's point, exactly, you know, this dialogue has been going ongoing for some time. We have a bilateral relationship. So we have a relationship with the sell side and their client, and there's a discussion point, and there's a different requirement of a discussion point. I think Matt mentioned earlier about sort of having dialogue with SIs directly. We're very happy to have dialogue directly. We're very happy to have dialogue with your sell side provider. We don't deal directly with the buy side, and that's a conscious effort because we just don't do distribution. The sell side and the tier one banks and the agency guys and the tier twos have got a very good and are set up to deal with relationships. We do risk offset and provide liquidity. That's a very clear market model that we maintain, and we partner with the sell side to optimize what we're doing with you guys. And I would encourage, and if you're not already seeing data around specific SIs, and I do say specific because if you interact with a broker that decides to interact with two or three SIs and the market moves against you, you need to understand who or which one of those SIs it is that's actually traded out or moved the market. Because actually, I know for a fact it's not me, but actually others, unfortunately, sorry. But you need to then have that dialogue and have the dialogue with us. So again, it's transparency. We live in an automated world, and what we do is quant-driven and automated. But actually, the human element of what we do has become more and more relevant. And someone mentioned earlier, I think James from Citi, you know, the sales, the move back to sales trading or whatever else. This is a very kind of hands-on, two-way communication that we have, and it's essential. And it's coming out in the metrics that we're seeing for month-on-month growth from a volume perspective. And if you've got a good platform, a good liquidity, and the ability to sort of take that down, then you guys will rightly see the right metrics and feedback.
I would also emphasize that what you have, it's a very interesting opportunity here where you get to actually hear the market maker's perspective on a lot of things. So this is one aspect, obviously, in terms of market structure, which is obviously very poignant. We've had three panels on SIs, and I'm getting a bit sick of talking about SIs to a certain extent. But ultimately, it's quite an interesting... I know, partially my job. So the other thing which is quite interesting is market structure in general, where you're actually starting to see like speed bumps, for example, coming up in the marketplace. And that's an interesting one, because that's actually also a market maker driven innovation, I'll say, in inverted commas, because actually what the buy side, I guess, need a little bit more education on is actually that this could be a negative impact on their trading, because it will drive down volumes, it increases inefficiencies, and just having a market maker be able to kind of like have a conversation and have the dialogue to really just bring this out into the open is actually a very interesting mechanism that MiFID II has brought about. So well done. There has been some transparency that has come out of this regulation.
Great. We'll come back to a couple of those topics. Just changing tack very slightly. So even though there's 133 SIs, there's potentially a lot more, maybe smaller intermediaries who are going to come into the mandatory SI regime. Maybe they didn't even realise it. And certainly that's true in when you look across all the asset classes. If you are one of those intermediaries or participants, what should you do beyond just panicking? Peter, is that...
Well, so I mean, I think fundamentally, the equity world is actually probably fairly well versed in what's necessary to actually sort of to do this, provide price sort of pre-trade. I think a lot of the heavy lifting has gone into sort of building similar infrastructures in the fixed income and ultimately in the OTC derivative markets, where actually perhaps that level of transparency hasn't been sort of quite so available. What we're seeing is actually people are putting in a lot of effort to make sure that that infrastructure is in place. And you have to get access to quite a significant amount of data in order to actually sort of make that work effectively. You have to have access to all of the thresholds, the large in size parameters and so on, and you need to understand how to apply that within the trading environment as well. So getting access to the data at the right time in your trading process, so you can publish a price pre-trade and immediately afterward publish the trade report as well, I think has been a significant chunk of the work. Particularly in the OTC derivative space, where people have tended to opt in, it's become a little bit more complex. And maybe I'll hand over to the ISIN expert on the end here to talk a little bit about that.
So I think there are probably two decision points, just to build on that, that seem to take primacy over almost anything else we hear. The first is this idea of where in the trade workflow and the trade lifecycle do you want to integrate? Not just reference data, but just right up front, the MiFID II aspect of it. There are obviously there's pre-trade and other pieces, but there's two ways to approach that. One is to literally have the whole thing embedded up front so it flows from front to back and you've got something that literally makes its way through the system, which means you don't have to touch the IDs and the trades in between, so it's less expensive in some ways. The other choice is to hive off the regulatory reporting aspects separately. That has quite a material infrastructure impact in terms of how you're thinking about your systems, but also how you're thinking about your strategy. And that's what's been really interesting again to us is when people are making those decisions and they sit down with us and ask us questions, they seem to be driving for not just, okay, I've got to get the bare minimum is I've got to meet my MiFID II requirements, but while I'm here, is there a small uplift that I can put in place or is there an efficiency I can put in place that allows me to benefit from this 3 months from now or 6 months from now in a cost-efficient manner? And so people are literally thinking, there seems to be a really broad spectrum in the SI world or even the bank world, SI or not, because we have a lot of banks and buy side actually connecting directly into us apart from the venues, regardless of whether they're SIs. And for them, it seems to be driven by what data they want access to, when they want access to that data, and how they want to integrate that information into their own systems. And not all that data is bought from us, just so we're clear, because a lot of these guys are sitting on their own information. You don't have to get everything, but the point is, how do you want it integrated? So that's the first big thing. And then the other part, again, goes back to the customer piece, which is, are you going to support your customer's assisted reporting? Some people are making a choice to, others aren't. The reason that matters is then looking at product coverage. So again, to Peter's earlier point, which is if you're going to have different institutions who become SIs in different asset classes or different instruments, as an SI or an intermediary, do you actually have the product coverage you need? And we're spending an awful lot of our time at the moment actually trying to work with industry, because we have all the we've got all the flow products out there. We've got some of the more interesting semi-complex instruments. They've been in there for months. What we're spending our time on now is working precisely ahead of the SI regime in March, trying to work with industry to say, do you have the edge cases you need so that come March the 1st, at least from a product perspective, you've got the coverage even on the complex end of the spectrum. So it's really product and workflow and integration.
Great. Okay, just conscious of time, just kind of moving now then to the final phase. Looking ahead to the future, across the spectrum as it were, how do you see, your customers' interactions with you vis-a-vis SIs changing over the next 18 months? Okay, we'll just do that in the most general sense. I don't know if anyone wants to come on.
Yeah, just to pick up on that final point as well from our perspective. I think certainly what we're seeing is those organisations, there are those organisations who opt in to the SI regime, as Peter touched on, and then there are those who get pulled in by the thresholds. And I think certainly from an OTC perspective going through to March, we've worked very closely with our APA partners. We provide the denominator information, if you like, within the market. The APAs are publishing on behalf of clients. They provide the numerator, and therefore clients are looking to their APA to say, can you provide us with how close we're getting to the SI thresholds? We do something similar ourselves, but the APA obviously has the trade information that they're publishing. So in that sense, I see a lot of organisations working to see whether they're going to be determined to be an SI rather than just finding out as and when ESMA published the thresholds and say, oh, right, now we've got 3 months to report. So I think people will get ahead of the game a bit more than they have done in the past, make it a bit more of a business conscious decision rather than the last decision, which was, oh, really, are we? We better get on and report it now, which has caught some, I suspect, by surprise.
So, right, just very quickly on that, okay, we'll come to those in one sec, just very quickly, almost maybe a sentence each, in terms of the next 18 months, more SIs, less SIs, changing nature of how you're going to interact with your customers vis-a-vis SIs.
I mean, I guess in the shortest possible way, I guess the next 18 months is growth from a volume perspective, and that growth is driven by more transparency around data. I think one of the guys from T Row said at Trade Tech he's not evaluating SIs until he's got 12 months worth of data. That's absolutely fine. And actually, brokers are now moving to where they're looking at performance around parent level execution. And you know, when you don't trade. I think the data is going to drive this. I think we're going to see some of the SIs drop away. I think some of the core players will continue to grow. Become more relevant. But actually, that volume is not going to go to an extent which is the numbers that some of the regulators and some of the exchanges have used to try and bomb the SI regime out of the water. I think we need to keep it relative and additive to the whole ecosystem. But again, dialogue, data-driven decisions and performance-based measurements on all SIs.
Yeah, I think I would echo those points. I'd say that as long as we can focus on the evaluation framework, I think SIs will go up, but I do think they'll peak and they should go down if everyone's focusing on quality metrics. So ultimately, as you kind of like learn the differences between risk warehousing SIs and more traditional market makers, you will start to understand the differences, and I do think there will be a drop-off in certain players who can't participate in the larger sizes or the larger or higher holding periods, and therefore, with help with the brokers and the buy side, all three together will create a quality framework for the right types of interaction.
Yeah. Anyone else?
I think there'll be consolidation in the equity space. I think in the other asset classes, fixed income and OTC derivatives, there'll be proliferation. And the proliferation will come from the fact that actually there are quite a lot of specialists in those markets, particularly when you get into sort of domestic markets that are actually not well served by perhaps the big bulge bracket firms, and that proliferation, I suspect, will end up with something closer to a couple of hundred SIs, actually not 133.
All I would say is I hate to do this. I couldn't quite make the beginning of the seminar say that whether there's a rule saying don't mention the B word. I apologise, but you know it's a bit. SI, rather like MTF, OTF, is an EU designation. We've seen certain MTFs now start setting up in Europe. Half the SIs currently are registered in London. Of the new 23 that got registered recently, 8 or 9, London. Come March next year, you know, if you want to stay being an SI, that either means creating a European entity, which will be your SI, and then do you run that in parallel? So from a venue and market structure perspective, again, almost every 6 months we could be throwing another 2025 into the pot purely just because of geographical location of an organisation and where it's registered and where the entity is. So I just don't see the fluidity going away, unfortunately, because of some of the political overtures that are going on.
On the OTC side?
I think on the OTC derivatives side, to echo what Peter was saying, this idea of I think there will be some level of proliferation just based on the needs and specificity of the type of underlying instrument or the type of piece, you know, the type of asset you're seeking liquidity in. But I think part of that will also be just, and this is just my expectation looking at the kinds of conversations we're having, I think there'll also be some level of bifurcation between the SIs that give you multi-asset class coverage and the ones that don't. Not necessarily from a price perspective, but probably from a servicing perspective, because already those institutions that have opted in are basically focused, regardless of whether they're actually reporting to FERDS or not, but they're already starting to talk to us about how do you drive efficiencies, how do they get more efficiency, having been mandated to come in with through the regulation, what else can they be doing to get better efficiencies, so that then, you know, you move from an implementation conversation to what else can we do and how else can we do it, not just for them but for their customers. So I think there will be some level of bifurcation in that space as well.
Great, thank you. Well, I think we've probably, I don't think we'll have time to go through all these, but very quickly then, they've all got one vote, so I may as well just pick one. The middle one is the classic, right? The absolute classic.
Can I have a crack at this?
So ELPs deal with brokers yeah. and so on, one way or another, the buy side send their orders to the broker sends to the ELP, one way or another, information leakage, ELPs evil. What's the story?
Do I look evil? Don't evil answer that. best meeting ever was going into a meeting and someone said, oh, you're not a robot. I think from my perspective, strongly disagree. I mean, we run an SI, the reason why I joined Tower, very strong governance, regulation and oversight. Our co-head of compliance sits in London. You know, he has a very hands-on control around what we do with the SI, and I encourage that and I welcome that, including risk and CTO. I think from my perspective, we run a third-party matching engine in our SI. We use Aquis. There's also a brilliant service from SIBO. Recognise those guys for innovating and offering choice, despite ESMA's attempt to sort of throw it out of the water at the start. So we use a third-party matching engine, which gives you the comfort that actually, you know, everything that we do is purely about passively putting our orders into that matching engine. You interact with that. Our legals clearly show that no information is shared in terms of unfilled orders or part-filled orders with anyone internally. It's purely a regulatory requirement for us to maintain those records and obviously report those as appropriate. So I think this is a really important question. And again, it's one of those questions where you're trying to evaluate the landscape, have a conversation, understand what the terms of engagement are, understand where that information goes, and understand where and where the oversight is around that. So, you know, we're not evil. We're here to trade. It's very clear, as I mentioned to you earlier, if you don't enjoy the experience and see a positive, you don't come back. It's as simple as that.
So I also agree with those, or disagree with the question, and agree with Simon. There's a shocker. Both of us disagree with it. ultimately, again, like, this is our view. How can the buy side look at this and actually come up with the actual answer as to how to do this? So again, speak to the brokers. What kind of information are they giving to the ELP? This is again where the power is with the buy side to have a look at this. Look at questionnaires. I mean, I don't want to go through the whole ALGO due diligence questionnaire again, but I mean, that is a great framework for being able to put this to the ELPs and basically to the brokers. So the one aspect to think, I absolutely echo Simon's points, but the one area I guess that we should also cover is streams and tiers, right? So there are streams. They are information that actually makes it easier to evaluate the ELP, not necessarily get information about the client. So, for example, having an above SMS stream, having a below SMS stream, those are the kind of information that technically is given away, but actually makes it a lot easier for the sell side to evaluate the market maker. So, again, don't believe me. You should be going and speaking to your broker about what kind of streams they are actually providing or getting from the market maker and asking what kind of information they are giving to the market maker.
Do we have time for one more? One more, and we have to go with democracy, don't we? So one's got two votes there. Right, so I think this the second one here, R27 results due to buy-side connect, sell-side connectivity rather than... So I think what they're saying here is someone comes along and says, right, we're the biggest SI only by virtue of the fact that there's more people connected to them rather than necessarily the sell-side have actually evaluated their quality of their liquidity. I don't know if any thoughts on that.
Shall I go first as the biggest... ELPSI in Europe by volume trading. Again, a great question. It's not inexpensive for the sales side to connect to an SI. They've asked and done a very, very detailed due diligence and review on what we're doing. They understand kind of the metrics around the technology, the liquidity. So this has been the first time prop firms like ourselves, Citadel and others have truly faced each other and actually presented ourselves as an alternative. And some of the sales side do not have the luxury of connecting to every SI. So they had to make an informed decision based on experience, liquidity, platform and other drivers. And actually, to their credit, most, if not all, have done a great job at it. Some have chosen to go down a very aggressive route and connect to a number of SIs and do an evaluation on the actual data. But actually, I would say the volume and our volume is based on a solid platform with good liquidity and good metrics that really just drive the volume in an upward trajectory.
Great.
I would also say that actually that question is correct. Penetration isn't there yet. So we were one of the last of the major market makers to declare as an SI. We probably have the least broker penetration, we think, and obviously we don't know. So we do think by end of year there will be a much better playing field to evaluate market maker versus market maker.
Thank you for listening to the A-Team Group podcast on navigating the emerging SI landscape, and we hope you found the content both valuable and informative. For more trading tech insights, do visit our website at intelligenttradingtechnology.com.